You are listening to the Brennan Center Podcast. Find us on the web at www.brennancenter.org.
Welcome, everyone. I hope you can hear me okay. But my name is Michael Lee. I'm Senior Redistricting Counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice here at NYU School of Law. And thank you all for being here for an event that where the topic has nothing to do at all with the presidential election or control of the Senate or the Supreme Court. All of the topics that have tended to dominate the nation's political news in say, the last 18 months. But the fact that you are here, I think, speaks to a sense in the public that something greater is amiss in our politics. In fact, it's remarkable to me when I go around the country and talk about redistricting how much everybody wants to engage on this issue. Because if one of the themes of this cycle is that our political system is rigged, this is perhaps rigging at its most basic. When President Obama, just as an antidote, when President Obama spoke about gerrymandering and democracy issues in his State of the Union earlier this year, we put out three identical memes. All of them featured the president speaking and had a quote, one about gerrymandering and how we need to fix that, one about money in politics, and one about the Voting Rights Act. The one about money in politics got 27 retweets on Twitter. The one about the Voting Rights Act got 76 retweets. The one about gerrymandering got over 900 retweets. So I think that gives you a sense of like how people respond in a very visceral way to this issue. Of course, gerrymandering is nothing new. In fact, it's as old as the nation. Even the founding generation was not immune to it. Patrick Henry, famous for give me liberty or give me death, was also a member of Virginia's state legislature at the time the Constitution was adopted. And he passionately disliked a man named James Madison and tried to draw Virginia's first congressional map in a way that so that Madison couldn't win a seat. He was unsuccessful, as it turns out, and Madison went on to go do many things, including seeing the White House burn during his tenure, but that's a different issue. But gerrymandering has been with us ever since. In fact, as the story relates, it's been with us before Elbridge Gerry and his famous gerrymander. And perhaps David can tell us why we call it gerrymandering instead of gerrymandering, but we'll get there.
I wish I could.
But as important as redistricting is, it often can be a dry topic. And the way that people, including me, have sort of tried to liven it up sometimes when we talk to audiences, to start off with maps. Which is always a good way to get people's blood boiling. You show them a crazy-looking district, and people respond. But that also is a little bit misleading because funny-looking maps sometimes can be pretty competitive maps, or they can keep district communities together, or give African Americans a chance to elect a candidate of their choice in the Deep South. That's not necessarily the way that we ought to be talking about this, but fortunately, we're lucky because, as David shows, there is a much more vivid and, in fact, much more outrageous story to be told, and one that ought to be talked about widely because it is at the heart of something that is fundamental to our democracy, the very basic ground rule. And when you look at much of the cynicism around the country, when you talk to people, if you've ever done electoral work for a congressional candidate, you oftentimes get told by people, like, my vote doesn't really matter. They've already determined who the winner is. And that's a deep sense, and it is something that should disturb us all. David, until recently, was editor-in-chief of Salon here in New York. He is a graduate of Boston College and attended the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He has since July joined the Connecticut News Project, which is a nonprofit news organization set up by some philanthropists and donors to produce deep reporting on government and politics and to be a resource for anyone who lives, works, or cares about Connecticut, and to hopefully hold policymakers more accountable. Until recently, he was a fellow resident of Brooklyn, but now he is moving to Connecticut and abandoning us in the greatest borough that ever existed. But at any rate, it's my pleasure to introduce David Daley, and he's going to make a few remarks about his book, and then I'll have a few questions for David, and then we really want to open it up to all of you, because this is a topic, as I know from experience, it's one that people have a lot of questions and ideas, and we hope to have a good, robust dialogue. So with that, David Daley.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, all of you, for coming. It's a real pleasure and thrill to be at the Brennan Center. You all do such essential and important work on this, so to be talking here with all of you is a thrill. You might not have noticed while frantically updating Nate Silver's latest odds on the presidential race, but look deeper into the polls and something historic is, in fact, developing. Democrats have put enough states in play so that Hillary Clinton has multiple paths to 270 electoral votes. But more than a month before the election, both sides can agree on this. The race for the House of Representatives is over. There are not enough competitive districts remaining for the Democrats to have any realistic scenario of gaining the 30 seats that they need to take control. Pollsters like to test something called the generic congressional ballot. Will you be supporting a Democrat or a Republican candidate? Those polls are all fairly solid right now. They all favor the Democrats with a margin of 4-6%. In fact, the election is looking a lot like 2012, when Democratic House candidates won 1.4 million more votes than Republicans, but Republicans retained a dramatic majority of 234-201, which House the Speaker John Boehner then claimed as a mandate from the people. It was instead a mandate delivered by brilliant and determined strategists, operatives, and mapmakers, and now something unprecedented in our time is about to happen. For the second consecutive presidential election, the party with the most votes will win far fewer seats. Want to know how wired these districts are? Take every nominee from 2014, add 7 points onto every Democrat, subtract 7 points from every Republican nominee. Even in that fantasy world, the Democrats can't reach 30 points. Why is this happening now? It's not a mistake. It's not a coincidence. It's because of the gerrymander, the oldest political trick in the book, but one which savvy Republican strategists, bankrolled by dark money, aided by sophisticated new map-making strategies, reinvented in 2010 and 2011 in a thoroughly modern and unique new way. Our democracy has, in fact, been rewired at its most basic level, the lines of our political districts. It goes a long way towards explaining why our politics feels so extreme, so broken, so dysfunctional, and so hard to fix. To understand how this happened, we have to look back first to 2008, which brought Barack Obama a Democratic supermajority in the Senate, as well as a Democratic majority in the House. It was the fourth of five elections which the Democrats won the popular vote. Go back and watch the live election coverage of that night, and the smartest minds in the Republican Party are despairing over the future of the party and demographic changes that could render them a minority for a generation. While they despaired, however, a brilliant Republican strategist named Chris Jankowski, the executive director of something called the Republican State Leadership Committee, had an idea. He realized that 2008 represented a Democratic wave and brought the historic election of an African-American president, but he also realized that the truly important election would be held in 2010 because, as you all know, the Constitution mandates the redistricting of every state legislative and congressional district following the census. Elections in 0 years mean more. They can reverberate throughout the next decade. He also recognized that while each state is a little different, In most every state, the legislature plays the key role in redistricting. The strategy was so simple and elegant, it's amazing no one had hit on it in quite this way before. target state House and Senate races nationwide with the goal of flipping state legislative chambers, draw themselves friendly districts that lock in these gains, even in blue and purple states, for the next 10 years. Karl Rove laid out the plan in the Wall Street Journal in March of 2010. When you draw the lines, you make the rules. The Democrats evidently did not get their Wall Street Journal that day. With 8 months' notice, they could not defend the state legislative districts Rove targeted in flashing neon lights in the country's largest newspaper. The Democrats' catastrophic strategic failure would echo throughout the rest of this decade. It was, in some ways, the greatest and most inexpensive political heist in American political history. This play costs the Republicans $30 million to lock in control of the House of Representatives, essentially, for the next decade. In Connecticut, Linda McMahon would squander $100 million on two losing Senate races. You look state by state at how this plan went. In Ohio, Republicans spent $1 million on state House races. They flipped the chamber. They gave the Republicans complete control, overdrawing 132 legislative districts in Ohio, another $1 million in Michigan, brought the House and Senate there, another $1 million in Pennsylvania, delivered veto-proof control over redistricting in yet another blue state. The following year, they press the advantage. In Ohio, Republican strategists barricade themselves into a suite at the Doubletree for months. They dub it the bunker. They told no one where they were. Together with strategists from John Boehner's team, devised new lines based on complicated mathematical algorithms. In Wisconsin, operatives connected to Paul Ryan barricade themselves in a law firm across the street from the Capitol, claimed attorney-client privilege for the maps they drew, required even Republican incumbents to sign confidentiality agreements before being shown their new districts. In North Carolina, they brought in a master map maker named Tom Hofeller, who treats redistricting more seriously than espionage and gives colleagues a presentation warning them never to send public emails, never to leave their computers visible, and not to fire the staff until you're sure the process is completely over. In Florida, strategists conspired an end run around a new state constitutional amendment mandating nonpartisan redistricting by running a secret shadow redistricting process and funneling maps through phony emails and former interns without their knowledge. So 2012, Barack Obama's reelected. Democrats hold the Senate. They garner those 1.4 million more votes. But in the first election run with these new lines in the House, these maps hold. They are the Republican firewall. And this is most dramatic on the state level. Michigan, 240,000 more votes for Democratic House candidates. But the delegation goes 9-5 Republican. In Ohio, Republicans narrowly win just about 50-50. They take 12 of the 16 congressional seats. In Pennsylvania, Republicans take nearly 100,000 more votes, but just 5 of 18 seats. This happens in state after state after state. The maps produce just the results they were intended. Now, as Michael said, you can trace gerrymandering back to Patrick Henry, 1788, the founding of the Republic, back to Governor Gary in Massachusetts in 1790. Both parties have done this for years, sometimes in cahoots. It has been a tool of revenge on an enemy, useful for protecting incumbents or gaining an undeserved seat. But beginning in the 1990s, when Republicans weaponized the Voting Rights Act and craft the unholy alliance with African Americans in the South, the gerrymander has become an even more devious tool to govern from the minority. It's more dangerous now because of technology. Gerrymandering from 1790 through 2000 is in the minor leagues. In 2010, gerrymandering essentially enters its steroids era. Determined partisan mapmakers have access to volumes of census data, voting records, reams of consumer preferences, as well as powerful computer programs that can instantly calculate the result of moving a district line a block in any direction. They can calculate algorithms designed to withstand electoral waves. It's the data, the technology, and the ease with which it can be manipulated that makes the post-2010 redistricting cycle fundamentally different from any other in our modern era. In 2000, remember, Democrats were able to ride the Iraq war anger in 2006 and undid gerrymanders in Ohio and Pennsylvania. That they have no hope of doing that this year under similar electoral conditions is a sign of how effective and enduring and different these lines from 2011 are. Indeed, if we fast forward to this fall, Michigan, a new Detroit News poll shows Clinton up 7 on Trump. There is one competitive congressional seat in the state of Michigan. Ohio, where Republicans control 12 of 16 still, not a single seat is considered competitive. Things look even better for Democrats in North Carolina this fall. Most polls show Hillary Clinton with a small lead. They show incumbent Republican Senator Richard Burr in trouble, as well as incumbent Governor Pat McCrory behind. It's a tough year to be a Republican in North Carolina, unless, of course, you're running for Congress. Republicans hold 10 of the state's 13 districts. How many North Carolina Republicans do you think are in trouble? You need not be Nate Silver to guess the answer. It's zero. All 10 Republicans, all 3 Democrats, are safe as houses. When our democratic institutions cease to be governed by citizens at the ballot box, they cease to be democratic. I'm sorry I don't have a happier ending.